In this week's edition of On Your Money, financial planner Kevin McKinley will share some more housing-related advice as we wrap up our series on home-related finance issues. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, some advice on selling your home by yourself or hiring a real estate agent. What to do when you can no longer afford your home, and what improvements you can make to give you the best return when selling your home. And answers to your questions, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome in Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So, Kevin, I wanted to sell my house a dozen or more times this winter and this so-called spring.
It snowed a dozen or more times this winter.
That's right.
Coincidentally.
Yeah, it was going to get a condo or it was going to go somewhere warm or something. But now that it's getting nice, it's going to be 80 degrees plus in Madison today. We forget about winter when the daffodils bloom. Spring is why we endure winter, I think. Isn't it, Kevin?
I agree with you. And winter helps keep the riffraff out. So I'm all right with that, too.
Well, we are going to end our series on home ownership and maintenance as April ends. What are we going to focus on this week, Kevin?
Yes, we've been notified by the FCC that we really have to stop this series. They said it's gone on long enough and it's diminishing the efforts of hundreds of years of public broadcasting. So it seems like an appropriate subject to finish up on with selling your home, and it's a good time to do it if you've been thinking about doing it. Prices, according to CoreLogic, are up generally for 12 straight months. So for the past year, home prices have been generally rising steadily. Interest rates are still at record lows on mortgages right now. Lending, if you haven't applied for a loan in the last year or two, you'll find that the standards have loosened quite a bit compared to a couple years ago. Supplies are definitely down, as we mentioned a few weeks ago. There's not as much speculation in the real estate market, and a lot of people are underwater on their homes, and so they just can't afford to sell them at this point. But if you are thinking about selling your home, you definitely want to sell it sooner rather than later.
Why is that? Why not wait for perhaps the price to go even higher on your home?
It could happen, but it may never come. Lots of things could hurt housing prices. Interest rates could go up if the economy slows down a little bit more and people become a little bit more hesitant about purchasing a new home. That'll obviously hurt prices. And lenders could become more restrictive, especially if we do go through another downturn here. If interest rates rise as well, you'll find that that will really dry up a lot of the buyers out there, and the lenders won't be quite as excited about lending to people anymore either. All of these things could lead to lower prices.
So things could get better, though, right? We're not necessarily going to hit a downturn?
Absolutely, and they probably will for this home selling season. But even if things do get better, generally, the supply usually increases to meet the demand. More people will become comfortable selling their homes. They think they're going to get a higher price. Or if there is not enough supply, supply happens in the form of new homes being built. Lots of economic interest really want to have homes be built for employment, for a greater tax base, to get the economy moving even more. So you'll find that force very difficult to ignore when you're trying to get the best price for your home. Plus, if you're moving and you're buying a new house, any future or current price increases in the value of your own home are probably going to boost the price of the home that you're looking to buy in the future.
So I'm staying put, but maybe you have convinced somebody on the fence that it's time to sell. What are the steps or the moves someone should take right now?
You definitely want to get going. This great land we've chosen to live in for some reason gives us about a 3-month window of the home selling season. Typically May, June, July is when the home selling season really takes off, and because of this winter that seemed to last forever, that's been shortened even more so. First, you definitely want to get your own appraiser in. We'll have a link up at onyourmoney.com of where you can find an appraiser in your area so that you can see what the actual value of your home might be to a prospective buyer. Also, get an inspector in, too, who can find problems before a potential buyer spots them, and that really breaks a deal right at the last minute. You may also want to get your CLUE report. Now, this is the background of claims that your homeowner's insurance company has on your record for the past 7 years. And sometimes if a lender finds something on the CLUE report that says, well, there's been water damage or there's been a structural fix here that we can't solve, that can also break a deal as well. And again, we'll have a link up to that at onyourmoney.com. And finally, if you're really ready to sell, get the best price you can, but then actually go ahead and sell the house.
Are you in the market for selling a house or buying a house? 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for Kevin. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And it is time for the On Your Money email bag. And Brian in Green Bay asks, how do you figure out which improvements will give you the best returns prior to selling? By the way, he adds, luckily, love the show.
Okay. Well, he snuck in with the false praise, but we believe he should be saying, I love the show, not just love the show. Thank you, Brian. Definitely worth considering if you are thinking about selling your home, because you may be able to pay cash or to borrow the money to improve your home. Well, the buyer may not. The buyer may be stretched to a certain point where they can only afford a certain price and no more, and not have the extra cash to improve the house as well, and then can't borrow to improve either. Or the prospective buyer may not want the hassle or the headache of trying to move and then or live in their old home while they improve the one that they're buying from you. But be very careful about overspending on any improvements.
How so? What do you mean about be careful?
Well, you're dealing as much with taste as you are with value. You're better off making structural improvements rather than aesthetic improvements. For instance, you might want to think about, you know, if the roof or the shingles need to be replaced, do that instead of redecorating or, you know, blowing out a wall or something. Keep it very generic so it's not only easy to deal with but easy to change if the potential buyer doesn't like it. And don't expect 100% payback. If you put, you know, $5,000 into sprucing the place up, you might improve the eventual price maybe by $3,000 or so, but you also may sell it sooner as well, because it just looks like the buyer can walk in. They're going through a tough enough process as this is. They don't want any more work than they necessarily have to undertake.
So where do you think Brian should start with prepping his home for sale?
I tried to look at the place through the eyes of a potential buyer, and again, that means hiring an appraiser or an inspector in advance, that's a great way to start, because they can point out not only some things that you might be able to do to increase the potential valuation, but also any structural problems that the inspector would find as well. Obviously, if you are going to hire a real estate agent, he or she can tell you some things that you might want to work on as well. If you have a very trusted friend or family member, I mean, who is willing to, the friendship is strong enough or the relationship is strong enough, they can walk through and say, wow, I love your place, but here a couple things you might want to look at. And you can also just have an open house, too, and listen to some of the comments that people make if they're walking through and they're potential buyers, and say what, you know, even ask them afterwards, say, what did you like, what didn't you like? That at least gives you an unbiased review of your place.
So do we know what are some of the most cost-effective improvements?
Based on a study published by the National Association of Home Builders, right now buyers are most interested in energy efficiency, whether that means appliances or insulation or new windows. Also more storage. That might mean closet organizers or shelving in the basement or the garage. And then focus on the rooms that are used most often, like the kitchen, the entry, the baths, the family room, etc. And, Brian, you can get a pretty good bang for your buck, again, by improving the paint, getting some updated colors, and maybe even paying a stager, a professional stager, to really glam the place up for $1,000 to $2,000, depending on the size of your place.
So, Kevin, does that study tell you whether you can sell a home or not if you don't have granite countertops?
You've obviously been watching House Hunters.
Yes,
I can tell.
Everybody has granite countertops.
It's always the granite countertops.
You know, seriously, though, my brother did try to sell a home last year. He's probably going to put it back on the market, but that was one of the, that's what the real estate agents were saying. You got to put granite countertops in this home if it's going to sell. But he's resisted. Maybe it'll sell this spring. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Bill in Racine is with us. Hello, Bill.
Oh, hi. Say, I'm wondering, we're both at the point where we've got to begin taking money out of an IRA under this mandatory distribution. The only debt we have, and we're lucky, is it's a 5% mortgage. So what I'm wondering is, should we pay down this mortgage or make some investment with the money? But, you know, the interest rates are so low, you know, paying down a mortgage looks like the most attractive alternative. But, any advice you can give us?
Yeah, Bill, by the way, we will gladly take extra preference to callers with names associated with anything financial. So, Bill, you get in. And any pennies are out there to call now. We'll put your name right to the top. I agree with you. I think 5% is pretty high for a mortgage if you already have to take the money out and pay taxes on it. What I'd like to do, Bill, is probably take out enough, not just to meet the mandatory distribution, but also to get enough to stay under the 15% federal tax bracket. And that's line 43 on your 1040. And for 2013, that number is $72,500 for married couples filing jointly, and half that for single filers. So you may want to take a little more out to pay that off. If your mortgage were in the 3 to 3.5% range, I'd probably feel better about just paying the minimum, making what you have to pay rather than accelerating it. And you probably don't want to refinance at this point. So if that's the case, yeah, I probably would just pay that down, save yourself a little bit on the interest, even with the tax deduction.
Okay, so that still looks like the best bet. Start paying it down slowly.
Yep, that's correct.
All right, thank you, Bill, for the call. Again, if you have a question for Kevin, be it housing-related or not, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard.
We are concluding our series on housing-related advice during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and we have one open line for you if you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Frank in Port Edwards. Hello, Frank.
Good morning. My question is much like Bill's. I do appreciate the information you're giving regarding preparation of properties for sale. I think I will be doing that perhaps next year. But here's the question for now. I have a $200,000 mortgage. The interest rate is 3%. I also have at Vanguard a total bond fund, and the total I have invested in there is about $200,000. But the yield on that is 2% or less. What would be the pros and cons of selling the bond fund and paying off that mortgage?
I love story problems, Frank, so thank you for your call. Okay, let's talk about the pros. The pros is that you are knocking down a guaranteed interest payment that you can't get out from under. The mortgage is always going to charge you X percent. So you stop paying that. The other one is that the mortgage is always going to be there until you pay it off, whereas the bond fund can rise and fall in value. And if the economy gets worse or interest rates rise or both, chances are the value of that bond fund will dissipate, and there's really not a ton of upside left with a lot of bond funds in terms of growth and value. Interest rates really have to fall dramatically for bond funds to rise dramatically, and the chances of that happening are pretty small. The bad news about it is you get a loss of liquidity. So right now, all you have to do to stay in your home, Frank, is just make that one little mortgage payment that your Social Security or pension check probably covers, and then you get 30 days to figure out where the next mortgage payment is going to come from. As soon as you pay that off, there's no more mortgage payment, but there's also a lack of liquidity. So what I would do is I would probably err toward paying it off because it's in a bond fund. If it were in a CD or savings bonds, I would say probably don't cash those out. But if it's in a bond fund, I would probably say you're better off paying it off. However, one thing I would do is I would establish a home equity line of credit with the lender so that you can then draw back on that equity whenever you want for up to the limit of the line of credit without having to go back through the mortgage process or worse yet having to get a reverse mortgage. So if you are going to pay it off, I think that could be prudent, especially if you have other liquid assets at your disposal besides the money in this bond fund. But if you don't, I would prefer that you keep the liquidity and just bleed it slowly out to finish paying off the mortgage.
Thank you. Sounds like what I would do.
Thanks, Frank. Hey, I just realized there used to be a denomination of money called the franc, but now it's the euro, I think, isn't it?
We give Frank advice here.
Yeah, we do. And we have plenty more of it for Brian in Whitehall. Hello, Brian.
Good morning, everybody. Say, Kevin, I received a mailing here from a major credit card company, you could say, about a savings account that they label a 360, and they offer a $25 bonus to get you started. They say there's no balance, minimum balance required, no fees or service charges, but from the graph they show on the mailing, they show an average yield in regular savings accounts and money markets is like 0.13%. They're saying their 360 savings account will give you 0.75%. But the thing that concerns me is they say you can do it online, you can transfer funds online or over the phone, but your new savings account will be linked directly to your checking account. Now, is this a legitimate proposal or is this something on the hook?
No, I think it's a legitimate proposal from what you've told me and from what I know about it. And even having it online, that's the way a lot of people work, for better or for worse, is having things be able to, money to be moved electronically back and forth. And it's generally much easier to do that rather than via paper. What they're probably doing is they are trying to do exactly what you think they're doing, which is trying to bring money into the institution. And there's nothing wrong with that. They're just choosing to do it probably by subsidizing the interest rate on the accounts. My guess is that rate will not continue for the foreseeable future. It's probably not guaranteed for very long, and once they get a suitable amount of money in, they'll probably go back down to a more market-based rate. As long as there are no huge fees or other expenses that you might incur with it, at that time, you get a chance to move it wherever you want if there's a better offer out there. But no, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with it. It's really sad that we, at this day and age, that we have to look at an interest-bearing account that pays 0.75%, 0.75%, and say, wait a minute, this must be too good to be true.
Okay, I guess our caller has hung up. Terry in Door County is with us now. Hi, Terry.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am considering selling my home up here, and it is a manufactured home, and I understand that the lending laws were a little difficult for a prospective buyer to get a mortgage loan. I'm wondering, you said some of that has changed. Do you have any thoughts on whether that's going to be difficult for me to sell?
That's a great question, Terry. The only person who can determine that is the actual lender, and I would advise people to approach lenders. If you're in this kind of situation, is let the lender say no and go to the lender, explain your situation. As we mentioned in the last couple of weeks, lenders only get paid if the loan gets made. So while they certainly are under certain constraints as to whom they can loan money, it's still in their best interest to give you the loan or to give somebody the loan. Now, another thing that you might want to do is establish that relationship in advance with a lender who says, no, we'll loan against your home, so that if you do get a prospective buyer, you can say, yeah, if you like the place, if you don't have cash to pay for this, here's the card of somebody whom you can contact, who may be more amenable to giving you the loan than a traditional lender or someone that they might want. And if you get two or three of those people, it's going to be more likely that the potential buyer gets the loan and you get what you want for your house.
Thank you. Great idea.
All right. Thanks very much, Terry, for the call. Edith in Waukesha is with us now. Hello, Edith.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This is a question that has been puzzling me for 12 years. I started Social Security when I was 62, and my birthday is in March, and I think I got my first Social Security check in August. And when my husband started to take his Social Security, he was 65. He still is working, though. And he also had to wait at least 4 months. And I can't understand why is that a person has to wait so long. It seems to me that one time somebody asked this question from you, and you said that it should be coming right away.
Well, I don't know right away. There's typically some paperwork, and you have probably sound like you have a better memory for what I say, Edith, than I have a memory for what I say. So good for you. There's obviously some paperwork involved with it. You can't just stroll down to the Social Security office and say, yeah, I'm here to pick up my money. There's some delay involved with it as well, and that can typically be 60 to 90 days depending on the process. But I would actually check with the good people. You know, people who have Social Security questions, it's a very important issue. Social Security Administration has one of the greatest customer support reputations of just about any government agency we deal with. They're just really good people generally. It's sometimes hard to get an answer that you like, but call over to the local office and just ask them the question and say, here's what happened. They might be able to look up your specific situation and say, oh, here's why this happened. Or if you need it, you can go online and go to ssa.gov. But yeah, I don't know the answer to that either.
They are right across the street from my husband's office, so...
Oh, that's convenient.
I can just walk over there. The other question I have is also about Social Security. My mother died one day before her Social Security check came. I just happened to be going through some papers last night, and I still have the check. My husband, who is an attorney, told me that I am not supposed to be cashing that check. And now 4 years has gone by, and obviously I don't want to give up that money.
Sure.
I just wonder, is that true that because she died a day before the check came, I am not supposed to cash it?
That would also be a good question for the good people at Social Security, but I would guess mm-hmm. that you can cash that based on the timing of it. But where you might lose out on it is many times those checks have a shelf life, if you will, that unless it's cashed within a certain period of time, they won't cash it at all, and you have to find a replacement. So take that check over to the good people at Social Security and ask them what you can and should do with it.
Good luck, Edith. Thanks for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and we are finishing up our month-long series on housing-related issues, and we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And our next caller is Beth in Baraboo. Hello, Beth.
Yes, good morning. My brother and I are in the process of selling my parents' home in Sheboygan. And the home was built in 1950, and it's been well-maintained through the years. But now that my parents are in their 90s, things have been lacking. And I think the main room that might cause some problems is when you go in the bathroom, it looks like the bathtub hasn't been scrubbed for quite a while. It is very dingy. I'm wondering if just refreshing, you know, doing the tub or putting an insert in, whatever they do to, you know, restore a tub would be worth the money, because the rest of the house I think might show well.
Yeah, I think that actually can be, especially if it's not a complete remodel of the bathroom. If it's something that's really more cosmetic, you know, it's a few thousand dollars generally, and depending on what you're trying to get for the house, that could make a big, you know, almost an intangible difference. If people, that's one of the first things they're going to look at, and there's just, you know, people have a strong reaction to kitchens and bathrooms when they're looking at houses. So if you can clean that up and make it look really clean, yes, I definitely think that's worth it. If it were a bigger project than that, and especially one where you weren't around to supervise it and watch how it's done, I'd be a little more leery about it. But otherwise, no, something like that I think is a pretty good investment.
Sounds good. Thank you for the call, Beth, and good luck. You know, Kevin, we've spent a lot of time over the past few weeks discussing some of the more positive aspects of selling a home or buying a home. But what do we do as homeowners when we can no longer afford to keep the house that we have?
Lots of questions about that. Even though things have improved in the housing market, there are still a lot of people out there who are in trouble and are trying to hang on to their homes. Right now, there are about 400 of every 400 homes in the country. About one of those is in foreclosure. Nevada leads the way with one out of every 300 homes is in foreclosure. Wisconsin's pretty good shape. Only about a one out of every 1,000 homes is in foreclosure, and that number has dropped 27%. Again, according to CoreLogic, over the last 27% over the last year. And many people who are struggling to make their mortgage payments are also underwater, meaning they owe more on the home than what it's probably worth, so they can't sell and use the proceeds to pay off the mortgage.
So where should a homeowner in this situation begin?
Many of them have probably already addressed this, but just as a reminder, try to raise your income and cut costs wherever you can. If you can find any part-time work to help supplement your income whatsoever, just about any job is easier than going through the foreclosure process. If you have to sell something like a car or a boat, liquidating assets is a last-ditch solution, such as, you know, cashing out of retirement accounts or selling life insurance or college savings accounts. And I'd only suggest that if this were a very temporary problem, meaning it's something that you can see the light at the end of the tunnel. If you can just get through the next 30 or 60 days, then it's okay to take money out of those retirement plans and pay all the penalties. But otherwise, you might end up in even worse shape 3 or 6 months down the road if you do that.
Yeah, and then what? What's the next step?
Start asking for help. Contact your lender. It's okay to contact them and let them know of your situation. Chances are they're probably aware of it because you might have been either late or actually missed some payments. And request a loan modification and say, I'm interested in this. Do I qualify? Don't expect them to give you an immediate answer or even a positive answer ever. So you want to go to HUD.gov, HUD.gov, and they have a great resource page there that we'll put up at onyourmoney.com that you can use to find out all the different programs that are available to you through the government. You can also find a government counselor who can help walk you through the process and tell you a little bit more about all the different programs out there that are available to you. And again, expect a certain amount of pain and expense, but it's worth it if it means you're able to hang on to your house.
All right. So what do you do, though, after all these options are exhausted?
You may still want to try to sell the house and, you know, put the price high enough up so that you can hopefully clear enough to pay off the mortgage in its entirety. You never know who might come by, especially in these times. Otherwise, the foreclosure process is there for a reason, and it's a pre-established legal process for people in this situation. You may want to get an attorney who specializes in the process, and do know that it will affect your credit rating if you go through a foreclosure, and it may make it difficult to not only buy a house later on, but also even to rent a home. So some people I've known who are going through the process actually start renting a place before the foreclosure starts because their credit report looks a lot better. TransUnion, though, the credit reporting bureau, says that a foreclosure usually knocks about 200 to 250 points off of your credit score, and that's typically a score that runs anywhere from 600 to 800, so that's a pretty substantial amount. And it does stay on your credit record for 7 years. It doesn't mean you won't ever be able to buy a house again or rent again or even get a credit card. It just means you'll have to have a few years of reestablishing yourself and your credit history to work your way through it.
All right. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Paul in Fitchburg is with us. Hello, Paul.
I've done some preliminary research on buying a duplex with the intent to live in one side, or the top or bottom, and rent out the other side. It seems really great, you know, not having to pay too much in mortgage and stuff, and it kind of paying for itself almost. Am I looking at it through rose-colored glasses? Are there any big cons that I'm not seeing for that?
The only bad thing about it, Paul, is that according to the arrangement, as you've laid it out, you have to rent this place out to people. And anytime you're dealing with people, there can be a lot of problems and headache. On paper, it's a great idea. And I, even with the people, I still would recommend it, especially if you're willing to start out and establish some equity and have a relatively low net rent cost. But you're not only going to be dealing with these renters, but you're going to be living next door to them, and they're going to be able to come to you whenever, you know, the light bulb goes out or the toilet gets clogged or whatever. So if you're prepared for that and you look upon this as saying, well, I'm going to do this for 2 years and I'm going to see how it works and I'm not going to overspend in case I do have to sell this thing 2 years from now because I just can't stand the experience, it's a great way to start and to get into a piece of property. What a lot of people do, Paul, is once they get into it, they understand what it involves and they like it, then they say, all right, I'm just going to move into my own home now and rent out the other side of this. And usually by that time, after 2 or 3 years, they get enough cash flow where they can offset the overall cost of managing two places and maybe even still make a tiny bit of profit. Owning real estate like this is a great way to get rich slow, and we're not talking months, we're talking years for sure, and more likely decades. But it's often a good start for people in building your financial security.
All right, Paul?
All right. Sounds great.
All right. Thank you for the call. Bob in Madison emails, our daughter is going back to college here in Madison. We're debating helping her rent versus buying her a property for 5 to 6 years. We would put down at least 25% of the down payment and look for a property that is in good condition and has 2 to 3 bedrooms. Hopefully, the rent charged to other roommates would help cover the mortgage, taxes, and whatever else. Any thoughts on which way to go here?
We're back again with another thing that looks great on paper. And some people have done this. I know people have done this and been very happy with the results. There are two issues with this. One is your daughter is going to be living with people and is going to have the dilemma of either answering to the roommate's concerns over keeping the place up or your concerns over keeping the place up. And sometimes that can create a lot of conflict. And as many of us know who lived with people in college, there's already a lot of conflict when young people living in a large house together. So that can create somewhat of an issue. And the second thing being is that when you're buying any kind of student rental, you have to look at not only what the current market is, but what it's likely to be in the future. And I know that once the sun comes out in Madison, the cranes start going up and new student housing is being built all over the place. And it's probably going to be a lot nicer than just about any of the 100-year-old homes that are in the area of most campuses. And many times students are going to prefer those nice new one or two bedroom apartments more so than they are some rickety old house. So if you can get into it and say, we're not expecting to make a big profit on this, we just want to kind of break even over 4 or 5 years, I'm okay with it. But boy, kids can make lots of different decisions while they're in college about going to different schools, about not getting along with roommates. So some of the headaches that are naturally attendant with renting out property can be exacerbated by the fact they're dealing with very young people and you're related to them.
Yeah, and wild parties.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
No, I wouldn't either. Bob, think twice and long and hard. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, answering your questions about home financing or other personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My mama told me you better shop a lot.
In our Shop Around segment for today, we'll talk about shopping around for a new home or, for that matter, a real estate agent. Once you've decided to sell your home, the next step in the process is to figure out whom. So, Kevin, what are our options there?
Well, you can either do it yourself or hire a real estate agent. About 80% of homes sold are done through a real estate agent. Up another 10% are done by owners with some little limited help, maybe from a listing service or something. Another 10% are straight out for sale by owners. You're looking at about 5 to 7% in commission costs. Now that is paid by the seller, and that can be a good chunk of money. On a $150,000 house, you're looking at $9,000. But you also have to look at that and say, if you are going to sell it yourself, you've got all the time you have to spend in doing it. You probably know less about selling a home than even the least knowledgeable real estate agent out there. And one of the things, for better or for worse, that you get by using a real estate agent is a greater exposure in the MLS service that you can sometimes get for a lower cost, but there's an extra incentive there for the person and the people to sell the home for you.
So do you have a preference as to which way to go?
So far, I have only sold one house. We did it ourselves with a little help of an attorney to draw up the documents. If you're on the fence, I would suggest you actually do start by yourself and see if you have the time and the patience to go through this. And if it doesn't work out for you and you don't sell it quickly enough, you can always call an agent up. You'll find someone who's more than happy to take over the job for you in exchange for the commission.
So where do we find our best real estate agent?
It really is like a job interview. When you sit down with people, talk with area lenders you might know, or accountants or attorneys or whatever, or talk with someone who's been in your neighborhood and has sold their house if you have some friends. Ask them about their experience with the realtor. And then once you sit down with the real estate agent, talk about their experience. Talk about how much time they're able to devote to the job. Is it a part-time occupation, or is this something that they not only are full-time, but they have some staff to help? If they're familiar with your geographic area, ask about what they would do as a marketing plan, if they have access to buyers for your specific kind of home. And, of course, one of the big issues is to say, what would you list this house for? And some people are tempted to go with a real estate agent who gives them the highest price at that point. That's not always the best person to go with. You might want to go with someone who's a little more realistic and is going to dampen your expectations at the start so you can be positively surprised down the road. And then finally, talk with them about what items might be negotiable in the arrangement. The commission rate, the length of the agreement, is this something you have to stick with them for 6 months, or can you get a 90-day window where you can reevaluate it at that time, etc.?
Well, we want to hire a good real estate agent. Can we fire our real estate agent if we decide maybe we want to try it ourselves? We don't think that person's doing a good job?
See, that's part of the problem. Mm-hmm. One of the things the real estate agent does is hopefully generate a lot of interest in the home. And it'd be very easy to say after, they've got 20 people to traipse through your place and have two or three different buyers and say, oh, hey, you know what? You're fired. And we're not going to pay any commission for it. So usually that's what the contract is for, to prevent the interest for it. But go over the contract very carefully. Carefully make sure you understand what your rights and your options are so that you can protect yourself, but the real estate agent deserves to get paid under the terms of the agreement as well.
So once you find your real estate agent and you put your place up for sale, then what?
You want to work with each other. This is a collaboration. You might want to have weekly updates via email or just a phone call to say, have you got any interest? If so, just to kind of keep on their radar screen, because the good ones are very busy. The bad news is you want to keep your house as clean and ready for showings as you possibly can at all times, so you don't have to, give it 48-hour delay and lose a prospective buyer. And then you might also want to set up pre-established monthly meetings with the real estate agent so you can kind of get just a half hour, an hour of FaceTime to say, okay, how are things going? What should we do differently? Do we have anybody else out there? And understand, some people say, well, I listed my place with this person and it never sold. Real estate agents do the best they can. They want to get the house sold, and sometimes it's just luck. It's still, like we've mentioned, a very emotional decision, and sometimes you find the right buyer at the right price, and other times that particular person just isn't out there no matter how hard the real estate agent works.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, here with us today for another edition of On Your Money, wrapping up our month-long series on housing advice. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Sherry in Lake Geneva. Hi, Sherry.
Good morning, Joy and Kevin. Good
morning.
My question is that my husband and I were baby boomers, almost 60. We wanted to refinance our home. We have about 8 years left on our mortgage, and we have a good credit history and a history of paying our bills on time. Yet we were turned down recently when we tried to refinance because we have a high, income to debt ratio due to the fact that we both had job loss and one or both of us have been on unemployment. And the reason for our high debt is only college loans. Mm-hmm. So basically, kind of a bad situation here, and I wonder if there's any recourse where we could get a refinance of, loan other than just a traditional credit union or bank that's apparently turning us down.
You might want to talk with a mortgage broker in your area. There are plenty down there to whom you can speak and just see if they, you won't be the first person who's come to their office with this situation, and they might know some lenders who might look at this a little differently. You're going to pay for it probably in the form of higher upfront expenses and or a higher interest rate if you can get it. But yes, that's one of the big problems with student debt, and we're seeing this not just with 20-year-olds but 50 and 60-year-olds is with $1 trillion of debt out there, it's keeping a lot of people from doing things they would otherwise be able to do. Like you mentioned, with a very good credit rating, it's still say, well, I'm sorry, you've just got so much of your net income going to debt. It's difficult to replace that. I would also see if it's possible to get some kind of larger refinancing if you can get an appraisal up, where you might even want to say, oh gosh, we could pay off the debt with the student loans with the proceeds from the mortgage. There are some other externalities with that may cause a problem, but that's one step to getting the mortgage at the new lower interest rate. And by the way, get it for 30 years, not the 15-year, in part because that will lower the payment, and you can always pay the loan off sooner if you want, but with that lower payment, that will help your debt-to-income ratio look a little better.
Thanks, Kevin.
Good luck, Sherry. Mike in Rhinelander is our next caller. Hello, Mike.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I'm 68 years old. I'm retired, and I've got money in Wisconsin Deferred Compensation Program, and I've been doing that while I was employed, and now I have a set amount. The problem is it's being managed by a company, and there's three different options. There's the minimum risk, moderate risk, and higher risk, and I do know during the downtime the money I had in there did go down considerably. So I at this point, because it's a 457, I have to start taking the money out when I'm 70 and a half. And I'm wondering, should I leave this money in Wisconsin deferred comp with the risk of it going down if we have another downturn, or should I roll it over into something else because it's an IRA type account? I was listening to Frontline on television. They were talking about all the major players in this funding organizations use index funds, and so I have no clue whether I should leave my money where it is or whether I should roll it over into something else, even an annuity. I did see one salesman that was trying to sell an annuity, and boy, they are confusing.
They are confusing. I bought my first stock when I was 14, Mike, and I've been a financial advisor for 25 years, and I'm fairly intelligent. I went to the goodest college in the Big Ten, the University of Wisconsin. Annuities are still confusing, especially when they plop that 250-page prospectus down in front of you. So I think you're right to avoid the annuity. If you have access to the regular state deferred comp plan, you have access to a lot of different investment options, and many of them are low cost, like the Vanguard options out there. You also have a stable value option in there, and you have a CD option. But if you're really concerned about it and you say, you know what, I don't want any growth, but I really don't want any loss, you can roll all of that money over into an IRA account at a bank or a credit union and buy a straight certificate of deposit. The downside of that is that you're only going to get 1 to 2%. The upside is that you are very unlikely to lose any money in that whatsoever once you get it over there. So yeah, you have to weigh out, do you want to accept the risk and accept the fact that you could lose 30 or 40% in a bad year or a bad five-year period in the future? That's what you accept for this notion of trying to attain a higher rate of return. But if you're okay with just hanging on to what you have, the CD at a local bank or credit union might be a better option.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Good luck to you. Marcia in Rice Lake is with us now. Hello, Marcia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Kevin, I have a question regarding my husband and I and our four children would really like to buy a new home. And right now we still have a mortgage of about $90,000 and then about $10,000 in other debts. And what I'm wondering is, I worked at a different hospital for about 12 years, saving about 3% in a 403B, and right now it is worth about $47,000. I have a current position at a hospital that I've worked at for about 4 years. I'm saving 11%, plus I'm getting about an 11% pension on that, and that has accumulated at this point already about $37,000 in a 401k. So my question is, do you recommend taking a separation of benefits and using that money to, you know, down payment for a new house, paying off those other debts? Because really we're feeling like there's no other way in today's loaning market to really come up with that 20% down payment without doing that.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. Could you start over, please, Marcia?
That was very clear, Marcia.
No, Marcia, I don't mean to denigrate. You do have a very good handle on the situation. It sounds like you've thought a lot about it. Do you know, Marcia, can you by any chance borrow against that previous employer plan?
I can.
Okay. I would prefer you not take any money out of it. But if you were to access that, I'd rather have you borrow from that plan rather than taking it all out. Because are you and your husband both employed?
Yes.
Okay, there's a very good chance if you pull it out and spend it, you are going to lose probably 20 to 30% of it or more to taxes and penalties, because you sound like you're under 59 and a half, right?
I am.
Okay, good. There's some comfort level to doing this that I get. I understand that. So I would rather have you borrow against it and use the money for other purposes and then pay that loan back rather than yank it all out and pay the taxes and the penalties on it, because it just gives you so much more flexibility and it's a much lower cost way to go than getting clobbered by the taxes and penalties versus what you'll pay on it if you wait to retirement. So get a loan rather than cashing it out.
Thanks very much, and good luck to you. Robert in Stevens Point. If you're brief, I think we have time for you, Robert.
Good morning. I have a question about a loan. In 2010, I borrowed there's about $57,000 left to pay on this. The interest rate is 4.5%. Per diem, it says 6.9, whatever that means. I have money in markets. Easily to pay for this. I'm 69 years old. What should I do? Should I leave this loan ride and pay my $535 per month, or should I pay it off?
That's hard to say without going too deeply into your situation, Robert. Do you have an inclination where you say, hey, I just feel better with no loan and less money, or are you okay riding the storm out?
It doesn't matter. Okay. It doesn't bother me.
If you're okay with it, then I'm okay with keeping the loan. You, at least with a loan, you may want to convert it to a fixed rate. Is that possible to do?
It'll cost $1,000 or something like that, won't it, to have the...
And what's the balance of the loan?
Yeah, I think so.
What is the balance of the loan?
Around $55,000.
Okay, you want to know something? I think your best investment, Robert, is to pay that $1,000, convert it to a fixed rate, and lock that in. That way, if interest rates go up, your payments won't go up along with it, and you'll still have the option to pay it off whenever you want. And if rates rise fairly quickly, that could eat up that $1,000 you save by not refinancing. So I'd like to see you pay that. It's a good investment, and lock in some certainty on that.
Good luck, Robert. What's the website of the week, Kevin?
Realtor.com can not only help you search for a real estate agent, but also gives you a ton of information about buying and selling a home, and also everything in your various market. And you can see what the competition is out there if you are buying or selling a home. Realtor.com, and we'll have that website up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Super. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And he will be back with us again next week for another edition of On Your Money, our special focus on housing-related advice over today. We'll get into lots of other financial topics starting next week. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Jane Rotunda for producing this program. Thank you for listening and for calling in. Join us tomorrow morning at 8. We'll have some fun talking with the author of Wisconsin Supper Clubs, an old-fashioned experience, during One Day Wednesday. That's tomorrow morning after 8.